The headlines: anti-poverty campaigners warn of a catastrophe and serious physical and financial damage to British families, with the energy cost in the UK set to rise by 80% from October. Israeli forces attack anti-settlement protesters in several areas of the occupied West Bank, injuring dozens of Palestinians, including a journalist. And Pakistan's government declares an emergency over monsoon floods that have affected more than 30 million people across the country. Our top story for this half hour: fears are growing over looming fuel poverty in the UK as the government announces an 80% rise in electricity and gas bills amid a cost of living crisis. Electricity and gas regulator Ofgem says it will increase its main cap on consumer energy bills to $4,200 per year from the current $2,300. The new measure will take effect from October. Ofgem has warned that prices are likely to surge again in the winter. The head of the regulator urged the next British Prime Minister, who will be elected next month, to take decisive action in accordance with what he called the upcoming fuel crisis. Britons are also grappling with soaring food prices, with inflation now at a 40-year high of over 10%. An anti-poverty think tank has warned of serious physical and financial damage to households across Britain. The Resolution Foundation has urged radical measures to prevent a catastrophe this winter. Leaders of Parliament in Wales and Scotland, as well as opposition parties, have called for an immediate freeze in the price increase. British people believe the worst is yet to come, and the impact of the increase in consumer energy bills will hit them the hardest in the winter.
But the thing is, we're not sure how it's going to affect us. It's all I'm saying, it's going up X amount percent, but in pound notes, we'll have to wait for the three-month bill to come in to find out, won't we? And, of course, being winter, it's going to affect us more. I mean, in the summer, when it went up, it wasn't too bad because we don't use a lot of gas or electric in the summer. So we sort of like we get by that one. But the next one in the winter, when that comes in, I think it's going to shock a lot of people, unfortunately. It's scary.
It just has to be a change in lifestyle at this point, you know, just turning on the gas when you can, when it's really necessary, or making sure that all the lights are definitely turned off and so forth. And it just has to be a change in lifestyle, because that's the only way that you'll be able to actually survive it. It's not going to be an increase in wages, I know that for sure. It's not going to be an increase in the income that I get every month or so forth. So it just has to be a change in lifestyle.
I think we probably will have to really think about what we turn on, and it's a bit difficult. My husband has dementia, so he puts all the lights on, and come the winter I know he'll be putting all the radiators on and everything, so I'll be bombing around the house turning everything down again. Yeah, so it's tricky for everybody. Very good Matt cartoon today in the Telegraph of somebody jumping up and down saying, no, I'm not jumping for joy, I'm jumping to keep warm. He's waving the energy price cut paperwork.
Israel goes ahead with a fierce crackdown on Palestinians in the occupied territories. In the latest episode of violence, the regime troops attacked protesters in a village near the West Bank city of Tulkar. The Palestinians were staging to vent their anger at Israel's settlement expansion and settlers' violations in the area. Israeli troops also attacked anti-settlement protesters in villages near Qalqilia and Nablus. Dozens of demonstrators, including a journalist, were injured as a result of Israeli gunfire. Israeli forces have recently stepped up deadly violence against Palestinians, killing dozens. Tel Aviv is facing growing pushback by Palestinians over its land grab policy and acts of aggression. Attacks on Israeli targets have killed several people in recent months. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has called on Palestinians in the occupied West Bank to continue to defend the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It has urged action to thwart attacks by Israeli forces and settlers on Palestinian sanctities. Hamas slammed provocative actions by Israeli troops and settlers against Palestinians and their holy sites in the occupied territories, including in the city of Al-Quds. It urged the Arab and Islamic nations to take effective action to support Palestinian people in the face of rising attacks by the regime. A day earlier, the Islamic Jihad movement said resistance groups remain united in the face of Israel's aggression. On this segment of the program, Iran's foreign minister says the outstanding issues in talks to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA can be resolved if the U.S. adopts a realistic approach. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says Iran's diplomatic apparatus is in the final phases of having sanctions against the country removed. Iran and the U.S. are maintaining indirect correspondence to restore the JCPOA, which was left in tatters after Washington's unilateral withdrawal in 2018. Amir Abdullahian, who was on a visit to Africa, made the remarks during a meeting with the president of Zanzibar, Hossein Mawinyi. Amir Abdullahian said Iran is one of the world's leading countries in medicine, high-tech industries, and other sciences, adding that Tehran is ready to share its know-how and technology with African countries. He also voiced Iran's readiness for cooperation in oil and gas extraction. For his part, Mawinyi expressed Zanzibar's interest in trade with Iran and investment there. Amir Abdullahian had earlier traveled to Tanzania, where he underlined the development of economic ties with African countries as one of Iran's foreign policy priorities.
Iran and Tanzania have vowed to draw a roadmap for developing bilateral relations in various dimensions. One of them is economy and trade. In this regard, Tanzania's business hub, Dar es Salaam, hosted a joint meeting of economic and trade activists from the two countries. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, addressed the forum, saying the development of economic relations with African countries, especially Tanzania, is one of the foreign policy priorities of Iran.
The African continent is one of the major economic diplomacy priorities of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Along this line, Tanzania, as one of the most important countries in the continent, has always had this special status in the foreign policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
He also expressed that Iran is prepared to help Tanzania achieve its goals of development and industrialization. He added that both sides are determined to prioritize economic diplomacy. Over 20 Iranian public and private sector companies took part in the forum to show Tehran's serious will for business cooperation with Tanzania.
Africa is a very huge market, and many world powers come to Africa for discovering new opportunities. So I'm here with the Iranian delegates to explore the east of Africa, especially Tanzania, to find out the opportunities, especially in telecommunication business, as our company involved in telecom sector.
Business cooperation between Iran and Tanzania is a bilateral opportunity for the two sides. In addition, Africa is a perfect market for Iranian goods like petrochemicals and the food industry products.
Tanzanian economic activists expressed their excitement about the expanding economic ties, saying they had been eagerly waiting for the joint business forum to kick off.
So there is a huge opportunity. Also, having this forum in Tanzania, we have been looking for it for several times. We have been asking for it because we know for all the challenges that we have been observing, this kind of forum can build up that bridge, can bridge up a gap of closing those challenges. So For us, it's a big marriage.
It is a fruitful opportunity for both countries, Iran and Tanzania, to do a cooperation in business, especially in trade, so as we can do exportation and importation of different commodities from two countries. And it is politically stable. We invite more Iranians and other investors to come invest in Tanzania. We have so much opportunity, so guys, you can maximize profit, but also make Iran better and Tanzania better.
Taking Africa's economic potential into account, the Islamic Republic opted to expand relations with African countries. Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian's tour can be the launchpad for the Iranian government's long-term plans to expand trade with Africa.
Tehran has attached considerable significance to Africa as it looks to expand its ties with countries beyond West Asia. And Amir Abdullahian's African tour highlights the view that the world is not limited to the West. Mahdi Abbasian, Dar es Salaam.
Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Executive Director of Afro-Middle East Center, Naima Jina, joining us from Johannesburg also. We have journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas, who's with us from the British capital, London. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Naim Jina in Johannesburg. Give us your thoughts initially on the importance and significance of the trip of the Iranian delegation to these African countries.
Well, I think immediately two important significances. One is that President Raisi, from the time he got elected, well, from before he got elected, emphasized that in his foreign policy, Africa would be a high priority. And it seems that he's rolling that out now in a practical way with this visit. And I think Africans would expect that the president would also visit. So one is that he's stamping his foreign policy objectives and priorities onto the continent in a sense. And secondly, I think that it's not coincidental that this visit is coming now, and the move to improve relations, particularly economic relations with African countries, comes as we are preparing to hear the announcement of the return to the JCPOA. That return would mean that the lifting of at least some or many of the sanctions on Iran, and will ease Iran's being able to do business across the world, including with Africa. So I think that it's significant from that perspective. And I think that certainly there are things that African countries can gain by Iran's involvement, and particularly as the foreign minister himself and President Raisi have said, in terms of building a kind of knowledge hubs, etc. So I think that there are things that we can gain. I think that there are, in Africa, there are people who are in general cautious about the role of countries from outside the continent and the activities here. But yes, I think that it's a mutually beneficial relationship.
Said Mohsen Abbas, give us your thoughts on the expansion of relations that we're seeing right now being instigated by Iran with African countries.
Well, there's two or three things. Firstly, I think that this is part of an overall commitment by the Islamic Republic of Iran, particularly under this new government of President Raisi, towards what was described as the resistance economy. So there wasn't a great emphasis by the Iranian establishment towards building relations with Africa. I think, of course, there were threats to the African nations in the background, many who are subservient to French and American and British interests, etc. But nonetheless, you'd say that they would have tried a little harder. And now what we've got is this huge push towards really reconnecting with not just the second and third tier African countries like Mozambique, Togo, or Guinea-Bissau, but also perhaps even the likes of Sudan, Djibouti, and others who had actually cut off ties with Iran on the say-so of the Americans, etc., during the sanctioning, the heavy maximum pressure sanctioning. Not only that, Iran needs a lot of these African countries because, of course, on the United Nations, in the African Union, on the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, they all have voting power as well. So it's important on a political and diplomatic level to have strong relations. But what Iran can offer now is what's really key. I think previously, when they weren't going for the resistance economy, there wasn't that much of a development of their own abilities internally to be able to offer, services. Well, now, with the medical and health advancements within Iran, which are huge, within the area of mining, which increasingly Iran is becoming very powerful at, energy, of course, they've always been powerful with the oil, etc. But don't forget the drones and the arms and the ability to create weaponry. All of these things are hugely attractive if at the right price. Iran could go in and compete, and if the sanctions were slightly eased, I think they could have a huge lucrative arena and market.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Naeem Jina joining us from Johannesburg, and Syed Mohsen Abbas speaking to us from the British capital, London. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Moving on, heavy rain continues to pound parts of Pakistan after the government declares an emergency to deal with the monsoon flooding. The government says 33 million people have been badly impacted, with the country's climate minister calling the floods a catastrophe of epic proportions. Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif has already appealed to the international community for additional aid and disaster relief. Since June, more than 900 people have been killed in the record-breaking monsoon rain. Sindh and Balochistan provinces have been the hardest hit by floods, which have inundated farmlands and destroyed millions of hectares of crops, homes, roads, and bridges. The UN's Disaster Relief Agency says over 180,000 people have also been displaced nationwide. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. The Biden administration says it doesn't share the Zionist regime's position on criminalizing six Palestinian NGOs, but also won't criticize the Israeli regime following a military raid on the organizations. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Michael Aria Ryder. This article is published under the heading Biden administration offers concern but refuses to condemn Israeli regime raids. Here's more. On August 18th, the Zionist regime forces carried out an overnight raid on the offices of seven Palestinian civil society organizations in the occupied West Bank. Armed troops stole documents, damaged property, and welded the office doors shut. Six of the seven targeted groups, including Al-Haq, Al-Dhamir, Defense for Children International, Palestine, the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, the Bissan Center for Research and Development, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, had been designated as terrorist organizations by the fake regime of Israel in October 2021. The Zionist regime has never provided any public evidence to back up these allegations, and classified documents obtained by Plus 972 Local Call and The Intercept show that the accusations are dubious. Shortly after the Zionist regime designated the groups as terrorists, they presented the Biden administration with what they claimed to be unequivocal intelligence against Palestinian NGOs. State Department spokesperson of the U.S. Ned Price told reporters at the time, "We received detailed information from Israel. We appreciated the consultation. We are reviewing the information that they provided us." That was 10 months ago, but the Biden administration has still not made a public conclusion about the evidence. At an April 2022 State Department briefing, Price reiterated the same sentiment from October and did not indicate that they were any closer to reaching a verdict. At the briefing, Price was hit with a barrage of questions from the AP's Matt Lee and Al-Quds' Saeed Aragat about the raid. Price expressed concern about the raids and said the administration was awaiting information about situation from its Israeli regime counterparts. The reporters asked why it hadn't released a statement about the evidence from October and why people should expect them to assess any new evidence in a timely manner. Lee told Price that the administration seemed to be in a perpetual state of limbo. "We have not seen anything that has caused us to change our position," Price eventually admitted, which marks the first time that the administration has acknowledged that it doesn't share the Zionist regime's position on this issue. However, Price refused to disagree with the Zionist regime directly, much less accuse them of lying. "So you don't believe the Israelis' information?" asked Lee at one point. "Intelligence information is always information that is the subject of analysis, and different parties can read information differently," responded Price, adding, "they can perceive of threats differently. Our own analysis heretofore of information that was provided last year has not caused us to change our approach to these organizations," unquote. When Price was asked why the administration is simply voicing concern instead of condemning the raids, he curiously referenced October evidence, saying, "I think the fact is that our Israeli partners took an action to designate these organizations as so-called terrorist organizations," said Price, adding, "What we have seen publicly, what they have conveyed privately in recent hours, is that there is an appropriate basis for the actions that they have taken. It will be a matter of urgency for us to review the basis for that information," he claimed. On Twitter, some pointed out that the Biden administration helped facilitate the raids via their inaction in regards to the original intelligence. To be clear, while this is the further U.S. government has come, it still falls very short of where it needs to be, wrote the Palestinian-American political analyst Yusuf Munayyer, adding, their equivocation for months emboldened the Israeli regime to raid these offices today. When will the U.S. finally condemn these actions? How much further does Israel have to go? The Biden administration has had Israel's evidence for almost a year, wrote Foundation for Middle East Peace President Laura Friedman, adding, it clearly knows this evidence is BS. Otherwise, there is zero doubt they would have validated Israel's designated the groups themselves. But knowing the evidence was BS, they appear to have taken the politically and morally cowardly approach of staying silent, an approach that amounts to foreign policy gross negligence and complicity. She continued, make no mistake, this is gun situation. Israel put the gun on the table last October. The Biden administration saw that gun and decided to do nothing to pressure Israel to remove it. Now the Biden administration cannot claim surprise. When Israel aims and fires that gun at the Palestinian human rights defenders. A few Democratic House members also called Biden to act. I am upset by the latest attacks by the Israeli army on Palestinian human rights groups, tweeted Representative Andre Carson, adding, silencing human rights defenders is an attempt to avoid accountability. I reiterate calls from myself and my colleagues that the Biden administration immediately condemned this repression. Also, Representative Betty McCollum said, once again, the IDF has launched a chilling attack on Defense for Children International Palestine, a human rights organization supporting Palestinian children. The Biden administration must condemn these efforts to silence groups advocating for Palestinian human rights and civil society. Last year, McCollum introduced a resolution calling on the U.S. administration to condemn the Zionist regime's authoritarian and anti-democratic repression of the human rights groups.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Welcome back to the lecture series. The lecture series, as you know, has been titled The Quiet Before the Storm. What we're trying to do is to examine the words, the teachings, the stances, and the thoughts of Sayyidul Shuhada. The idea is to learn relevant lessons before our Imam returns. We want to learn lessons that apply to us, that make us ready to accept the wilaya of God on the earth. So tonight's reminder from Abu Abdullah, brothers and sisters, is called Cultivating the Love of Imam Hussein in the Next Generation of Muslims. Cultivating the Love of Imam Hussein in the Next Generation of Muslims. We have a beautiful hadith from our Prophet. It's narrated that our Prophet said this, Addibu awladakum, train your children to have three noble traits. What are the three noble traits? حُبُّ نَبِيِّكُمْ. The first of them is the love of your prophet. وَحُبُّ أَهْلِ بَيْتِهِ The love of his أَهْلُ الْبَيْتِ وَتِلَاوَةِ الْقُرْآنِ And also, your children, they should love to recite the Qur'an. So, brothers and sisters, as you listen to the poetry of our dear brother, and you remind yourself of what we read in the books of history, you know and you recognize that children played a huge role in the advent of Karbala. They're part of what makes the story so special. Now, what I want to do is to explain about a family, to talk a little bit about one of the families in this incredible story. And then after that, to see if there's any lessons that we can draw from their story. The hero in our story, according to some accounts, is a preteen. Some accounts, there's differences amongst the historians on the age of this young man, definitely a young man, but some say 13, some say 9. Young man. His name is Amr bin Junada al-Ansari. But I want to talk about his family. This story, you might know this man, but maybe not by name, but you might know him by his line of epic poetry. That line of epic poetry that Amr recited is Amiri Hussein wa ni'mal amir. Even that line needs discussion. My amir, my leader, my role model, my example, my everything is Hussein. And what an excellent amir he is. But his story is a very incredible one. What happens is he has come to the battle with his family. So the family of Amr, they meet Imam Hussein alayhi salam in Mecca. What happens is Janada, his father, so this is Amr bin Janada, and his mother is, according to some accounts, is named Bahriya. This small family is traveling. The father is one of the companions of Rasulullah, Ashab Rasulullah, and he was a loyal companion. He actually did a tour of duty in Siffin. He was a loyal Shia. He was there active doing his social and political responsibilities, even in the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen. And then now when he hears the Imam is exiting Mecca, at that time is when this small family joins the Imam on that caravan moving to heaven. What happens is that Janada, Amr, his mother, they're all moving towards Karbala, and on the day of Karbala is when his father finally realizes that dream that he had, that hope that every Shia has. He was able, he was gifted, he had the tawfiq to fight for Imam Hussein, Sayyid al-Shuhada, and to be martyred. But their story doesn't end there. In this story, the mother is a heroine. The mother is all in for the cause. She's just lost her husband. She's there, but she realizes the gravity of the situation, the seriousness of the situation, and her attitude is next man up. She tells her young son, go and fight and defend the daughter, the son of Fatima. Go fight and defend the son of Rasulullah. This young man comes out and respectfully asks Imam Hussein for permission to fight. The Imam tells him no. The Imam tells him no. When he asks for permission to fight, the Imam says words to this effect, that he's a young man. They've just given one person in the way of Allah. His father just passed. They fought. Maybe his mother is not happy with him also becoming shaheed. The young man answers, he says, Ummi amaratni bidhalik. My mother is the one who told me to go over and fight. When the Imam sees that level of sacrifice, this young man ready to take on the Yazids and Shimrs of his time, this young man advances and then he begins to recite that epic poetry, Amiri Hussein wa Ni'mal Amir. Even when you look at his epic poetry, that's interesting. His epic poetry doesn't reflect the name of his tribe or his father or any of his personal achievements. Everything for him, if you read the lines of poetry, is Imam Hussein. Everything for him is Hussein. He's martyred. When he's martyred, the enemy callously throws the head of this young man back towards the camp of Imam Hussein. Every stance of these people who had received tarbiyah from Sayyid al-Shuhada is a lesson for us. The mother takes the head and throws the head back at the camp of the enemy. What is the message that she's sending by doing this? He was given in the way of Allah. I don't regret anything. So now the question for all of us when we hear these wonderful stories is, how is it that a family would succeed in doing, following those instructions, that the love of Allah, the love of Rasul, the love of Islam has been manifested not only in the father and the mother, but in the young boy to the extent that not as he, his goal isn't just to practice Islam, his love, his desire is shahada. Even when the imam gives him a way out, he says, no, I've got to go. What did they do? What's there in the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt that would enable someone so young to make these choices?
To Allah, whenever I face troubles in my life, I close my eyes and see your shrine and call back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah, until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Rather than going around the world collecting military allies and imposing sanctions on countries that do not wish to align with the United States, China invites partners to collaborate on mutually beneficial basis. We now present you an article written by Dr. George Koo, the founder and former managing director of International Strategic Alliances. The piece is titled Disintegration of Unipolar World Begins. In April, I was invited to speak about the U.S.-China bilateral relationship. For the title of the speech, I chose Pushing China's Head Underwater Won't Make America Great Again. Recent developments suggest that an updated title would be Pushing China's Head Underwater Will Hasten America's Own Demise. There are two reasons for fine-tuning my title. First, the United States' deliberate tactics to obstruct China's growth and expansion have failed miserably while inflicting more hardship on Americans. The American people are paying a ghastly price for Washington's obsession with China. Second, priorities of America's foreign policy are not making any sense. The most recent example is the announcement by President Joe Biden that the United States will contribute $200 billion to the G7 pool of funds to compete with China's Belt and Road Initiative, the BRI. It's hard to tell whether where Biden is going to find that money. Even if all Group of Seven nations contribute their share of funds, it will be even harder to figure out to how they can implement the Belt Road Initiative-like projects in the developing world. Most probably, they would have to subcontract work to China, which knows how to implement it. On top of Biden's dream of grandeur, he's sending billions of dollars worth of arms and weapons to Ukraine to prolong the conflict with Russia. Bipartisan approval is easy when it comes to making war. By contrast, to relieve the inflationary pressure on the America's domestic economy, Joe Biden is proposing to forgive 18 cents per gallon, or 4.76 cents per liter, of federal tax on gasoline for the three summer months. Wow, billions of dollars to compete with China and Russia and an 18-cent discount for the American motorist. In California, a gallon of gasoline has gone over $6, or $1.59 a litre. Saving 18 cents per gallon from a fill-up will barely cover the cost of a cup of coffee. In the United States, prices of everything has gone up. Inflation looms. Nay, inflation at 8.8% is already the highest in the past 40 years. Soon the American motorist won't even get a cup of coffee from his gas tax saving. Biden does not deny that Americans are facing inflation. He blames the inflation on Russian President Vladimir Putin and his special operation in Ukraine. He urges the American public to endure this for as long as it takes in order to defeat Putin, hardly encouraging words. Of course, most American people are not aware that it has been the US-led North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, that baited Putin over the decades into the conflict with Ukraine. Washington has since congratulated itself for successfully mounting a proxy war, getting Ukrainians to fight the Russians. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin even claimed that the war meets the objectives to wear down the strength of Russia, albeit at the expense of Ukrainian casualties and Ukrainian property. NATO celebrated a summit at the end of June where Sweden and Finland were formally included as new members. The organization accused China of not condemning Russia's special operations in Ukraine and therefore not standing with NATO. At its NATO summit, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, South Korea were invited as observers, as a signal that NATO's expansion plans now include the North Pacific. Just to make sure nobody misses that intention, for the first time NATO identified China as a potential threat and a systematic challenge. So what constitutes China's threat to the security of NATO members? Apparently, it is the fact that China has dominated manufacturing of goods and prices that the West cannot compete with. China's gross domestic product, or GDP, continues to grow, and that makes NATO members nervous. The West, led by the United States, has repeatedly accused China of violating rule-based international order. The most recent action by the Biden White House was to impose sanctions on goods made in Xinjiang province, alleging human rights abuses in China's Xinjiang province. In response, China, on the day after the conclusion of the NATO summit, announced the placement of an entire order for 292 commercial jetliners worth more than $37 billion with Airbus, the European consortium, and none to Boeing, the other major plane maker. This was a harsh, attention-getting message from China in response to President Biden's endless innuendos and baseless insults and a signal that China is ready to play hardball with Washington. China's other message to the countries in the European Union, many of which are members of NATO, the Airbus order reaffirmed that China can be a major economic partner and poses no threat to the security of the European Union. Inflation in the European Union is rapidly getting out of control because of the war in Ukraine and the US imposed sanctions on Russia. If Joe Biden thought he was driving a stake into the heart of Russia's economy, he miscalculated. Vladimir Putin turned around and pegged Russia's energy exports to the ruble. Consequently, the value of the ruble against the euro has reached a 7-year high. The artificial shortage in world oil caused by the US sanctions on Russian oil has not hurt Russia. It makes money selling its oil to China, to India, and to other buyers at higher prices. However, major nations in the European Union, especially France, Germany, and Italy, are energy importers, and they are beginning to question the wisdom of following the US leadership. The world is beginning to see the difference between currencies based on assets and the American dollar, based on the full faith and credit of the US government. In other words, the Federal Reserve's printing press. Central banks of various countries are beginning to lighten their dollar holdings in favor of other reserve currencies, the most popular being China's renminbi. According to the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, the US dollar's share of the global currency reserves has fallen to its lowest point in more than two decades. To take advantage of the availability of Russian oil at favorable discount, India entered a rupee-for-ruble deal and get around paying in dollars. For the first time, India bought coal from Russia with the Chinese renminbi. While the G7 and then the NATO summit meeting took place in Europe, it was China's turn to host the BRICS meeting, which it did virtually. At the 2022 BRICS summit, Beijing invited many non-member countries as observers. Formed back in 2009, BRICS consists of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. It is not a military alliance, but it's meant to promote collaboration for peace, for security, and global economic development. Compared with the G7, BRICS has three times the population, but only about 70% of the G7's gross domestic product, or GDP. At the 2022 BRICS summit, Argentina and the Islamic Republic of Iran formally applied to join BRICS. Adjusted for purchasing parity, the gross domestic product for BRICS Plus would surpass that of G7, and there is a proposal afoot to create a new global reserve currency based on the basket of BRICS Plus currencies as an alternative to the US dollar. Rather than going around the world collecting military allies and imposing sanctions on countries that do not wish to align with the United States, China invites partners to collaborate on mutually beneficial basis. Since it was initiated in 2013, China's Belt and Road Initiative, BRI, has launched more than 13,000 projects in 165 countries, valued at nearly $1 trillion. Most of the Belt and Road Initiative projects have to do with upgrading badly needed infrastructure, which leads directly to a boost in the recipient country's economy. There is now a high-speed rail link from China through Central Asia to Moscow, Russia, and onwards to Rotterdam on the Atlantic coast. 25 out of 31 Latin American countries are participants in the Belt and Road Initiative, as is most of Africa. At the just-concluded Group of 20 summit, the divide between the US-led Western Bloc and China, Russia, and the non-aligned members of the G20 became quite clear. The summit concluded without the usual group photo of smiling state leaders and no joint declarations expressing optimistic steps for the future. Every year, China graduates 8 times as many students in STEM or science, technology, engineering, and mathematics than the United States. These human resources power developments in high technology for China. The more pressure the US exerts to stifle China's advance, the more determined the Chinese will be to find their own technical advances and skirt around American roadblocks.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered on January 23, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the eulogists of the household of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa ali on the occasion of the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha.
The last point is about saying things based on solid facts. In your morning ceremonies, in your elegies, and in your speeches, the things you say should be well documented and have a firm basis. You must study and work. You should read books. Of course, I know that many of our dear elegists already do this. They read books and they read outstanding poems. Thus, they master literature and raise the level of their religious knowledge. This will pour forth from them in their gatherings as well. You must do something to make this all-encompassing and widespread, because a doubtful statement is dangerous. Sometimes it happens that a doubtful, incomplete, incorrect statement is used by the enemy to question the essence of Shaism. Sometimes we may make a wrong comment and this allows others to attack us. Well, this is of no significance, but sometimes the wrong comment that we make causes others to attack Islam, Shaism, our Islamic teachings, and our great scholars. This is not permissible. You should be very careful. So making comments with a solid, firm base should definitely be included in the agenda of our dear elegists.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Today's meeting was very good and I have benefited from it. I thank the friends who participate in the program here. I also wish to thank the friends who have come from outlying cities in other provinces, from Zahedan and Ardabil, and from Arab countries, in particular our brother from Bahrain. I asked Mr. Vaizi, who came from Mashhad, the people who came from the cities I mentioned, and also those who came from cities I did not mention, to send my greetings to our dear people in those cities. I hope that you will always live and achieve success under the shadow of the blessing of the Imam of our time. May our souls be sacrificed for his sake, inshallah. Our Lord, by Muhammad and his household, make the blessing of remembering Imam Hussein increase in our country on a daily basis. Our Lord, bestow your grace and blessings on the tongues that speak in eulogizing Hussein ibn Ali and the Prophet's household. Our Lord, allow our hay'ats to please Imam Sadiq. Make us the soldiers in the great jihad that exists today, the jihad of clarification. Our Lord, associate the pure soul of our magnanimous Imam and the pure soul of our great martyrs with the immaculate souls of the Imams alayhim assalam. Make the holy heart of Zahra Siddiqat al-Kubra, peace be upon her, satisfied and pleased with us. Make the blessed heart of the Imam of our time, may our souls be sacrificed for his sake, satisfied and pleased with us. Send our greetings to that great Imam and help us gain his satisfaction and approval. May God's greetings, mercy and blessings be upon you all.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.